So yesterday, we looked at one of the greatest equations. Yeah, I turned it twice, sorry.
The Dirac equation. Ooh, it's definitely on now. And it's beautiful. But as I keep emphasizing, and also, you will be asked the question in the interview, what is a Dirac equation? But now you know. You have to write down the equation, you have to explain what all these things are. Further on, you have to provide some condition on the gamma matrices. And you have to tell me that Poisson needs to transform a certain way in order to fully answer the question. So, and okay, so this is normally what the people write as a Dirac equation, and I'll write it again. Yet again, with every index is restored as a matrix acting on vector equation. So remember, it's always like that, except that nobody likes to carry these spinner indices around. They are always suppressed in books, in whatever reference you find. So eventually you'll get used to these A's and B's that they're hidden there, but they are not explicit. So this is the Dirac equation. Then importantly, to mention the Dirac algebra. And also importantly, to mention the Hermitianness of the Hamiltonian and how this thing transforms. And all these together combine to give the full story of a Dirac equation. And the last part of the story is what we did at the end of the class, is we figure out what this guy is. And then, so now let me pause and make a couple comments coming from looking at the things I need to clarify part of the quiz yesterday. So one thing is that the people ask, what is representation of the Lorentz group, i.e. this S lambda? They are the how things transform, which is the representation of a Lorentz group, has anything to do with spin, which is a very physical thing. This, I'll encourage you to look at on the wiki, there is a tutorial on Lorentz group, and it comes with the exercise, with the solution. So you don't have to do all the exercise provided that, but just read it through, especially the first part of the tutorial derives the Lorentz algebra, and then the next part of the tutorial say, oh, when we casually talk to our friends about a particle, and it says mass, blah, blah, spin, blah, blah, then you should ask the question, what is mass? Mass is actually, well, that we actually know. Mass is basically the eigenvalue of, mass square is the eigenvalue of momentum operator square, which can be proved it's a Casimir operator, which means it like a commutes with all the generators. And then the last part of the tutorial shows that the spin is another this kind of really nice operator that it doesn't change in different Lorentz frames such that we can use it to label a particle. So if you look at that with the solution, if you feel like, but all you can just read through the tutorial and assuming everything is proved, then you will have an opinion why and representation of a Lorentz group is related to something physical, which is spin and mass. Another comment is by looking at the quizzes, it seems that quite a few of you guys have a question that I should have clarified yesterday, but I forgot. Is that this coefficient is chosen to be 1/2, which is for a reason, but it's really a convention. But we choose this convention is because when you do this, because the anti-symmetricness, if I just grab a random example, if I care about this component, it always have two terms contributes exactly the same. So we just put the half there so this business is taken care of. And then the other convention is normally when you see you expand a group, it seems more likely people will expand it as e to the I something. And that's mostly because people study unitary group. And if you're a unitary group, if you choose the convention to be e to the I something, then you can prove that the generator is Hermitian, which is nice, but it's a convention. And for our purpose, as you have seen in the quiz, that Lorentz group, all its Lorentz representation is not unitary, well, some of them is not unitary anyway, so there's really no point of putting the I there. Putting the I there wouldn't make your generator Hermitian anyway. So that's how we choose our convention, but if you read, I believe Tang does put an I there, but then he just put a minus I here. So the point is, this whole thing needs to be the same in any convention, but some people like to I there, some people, like it's a convention. This 1/2 and this 1/4, you can't choose independently. Because if you plug this in, it seems it gave you 1/8 this times that. That thing is fixed. Everybody agrees on that. But how do you separate which part, which number you put in front of this commutator, which number you put in from there? It's entirely depend on the author's taste. And our taste is, since these things are not unitary, there's no point for that. And it doesn't make sense to put a 1/2 because there is always two contributions exactly the same. So that's why when you look at the feedback yesterday, there were a bunch of things like there's a factor of 2 here and there. Okay, so let's continue. At this point, we introduce the chiral wire basis. I have no idea how he found it, but the thing you can think about it is that if you really wanted to, so this is a 2x2. This is a 2x2. Because the rest is polymorphic. The thing is that if you want the gamma matrix to be 2x2 matrix, it's just not going to work. You have the polymatrix, which is nice, but then there's only 3 things can be anti-commuting with each other, as required by the Dirac algebra. The 4th thing is basically identity, which doesn't do the job. So that's why people say, oh, let's step up to dimension 4. And then you have 2 copies of polymatrix to play with, and that does do the job. And what I also need to mention, thanks again to some people's question, I can't remember whose, is to mention that this basis is unique in the sense that everybody else is equivalent to this. So you know that the equivalent thing, if you can find a similar transformation to transform your gamma matrices, then you can generate infinite many, literally infinite many of bases. And this one we particularly like for, and also the uniqueness, actually I quote a reference in the note, you can check it out, somebody proved, says that you can prove whatever basis you write on a general basis satisfy Dirac algebra, you can show there exists a similar transformation using which particular unitary matrix to turn them into this. So basically, well, did the work find one set, then it's done. Done deal. No more inequivalent gamma matrices. Okay, so the reason we introduced the chiral Weyl matrix basis is that we wonder what's the rotational matrix actually look like. This we did in class, and hopefully you also take a look on your own when you're working on the quizzes. And that's something, that's what we get. And you are asked to do this. And most of you got it? It looks like this. Okay, so now, so that's what we have done yesterday, including at night, with the quiz on your own.
So the uniqueness of the Dirac matrices, do you mean that they're unitary equivalent if they satisfy the condition, the anti-commutative condition?
Yeah.
Thing below?
Yeah.
Just the anti-commutative
relation? Of, like both. Like anything you write down that satisfies this, you can find a similar transformation that changes it into this.
Okay.
So there's.
So the fact that gamma mu dagger equals gamma zero, gamma mu, gamma zero is not a consequence of the anti-commutation relations, right? That's an additional constraint.
That's what I think, but I'll double check.
Okay.
Now I'll double check on that, what this condition actually do
for us.
Okay, so pay attention to what we have calculated. So one of the questions in the quiz asks, which of them are unitary? Unitary says is that if this matrix, the unitary condition states that the U times U dagger should equal identity, or sometimes it's written as U dagger equals U inverse. So if you have an exponential to some imaginary number, then you time it's the dagger, it's like e to the I theta times e to the minus I theta, you can get identity. But in this case, you have a real number there, so you're not going to get unitary out of this. So this is not unitary. And this is unitary. And then the next question is slightly tricky. Ask if they are block diagonal. Well, they are manifestly block diagonal. I was written it as a 2x2 block. There is something in this block, something in this block. There's nothing on the off block. So they are both block diagonal. But remember, there is the infinite number of bases you can generate. And you can, if you think about it, if you just put like some unitary matrix on the left, the unit matrix dagger on the right, you can easily make it look as messy as you want. So that's why this is only block diagonal in the particular Weyl basis. Okay, so, yeah, yes.
Yeah, so the boost matrices are not unitary.
They are not unitary.
Does that mean if you boost something, you cannot unboost?
It just means that you can unboost. You unboost is always possible, but it's just not the adjoint. It's just not the it's the self adjoint. The adjoint equals inverse. There's always an inverse. It's just we have to calculate what's the inverse. We kind of just happily add this minus. I say, hey, this is the inverse. Okay. So what? Why would we care if they block a diagonal or not? That's nice. That's definitely nice, but that's a much harder task. So in when you study Lie algebra, remember we're looking for some representation of Lorentz group. If you have block a diagonal representation, that means
separation.
It's reducible. We come to this conclusion that the Dirac spinner is actually reducible. Well, it's block diagonal, so it says I could write a Dirac spinner into two halves. W stands for while, because he's the guy that discovered. And then you can say, actually, I can have two while spinner, which each are only two components. Well, that's making things simple. And you can actually show these two components are inequivalent. So there is a two-dimensional representation, and there's another two-dimensional representation, which are inequivalent together. When we put together, we get a Dirac spinner out of it. So if you compare the spinner and how they transform, you realize this W plus minus transform the same way in rotation. And then they transform in a slightly different way in boost. So at this point, we're just doing this because for the mathematician think, in mathematical sense, if I can make things easier from a big reducible representation into two smaller irreducible representation, we are probably going to benefit somehow. And we will benefit tomorrow. And this afternoon in the tutorial, we'll study them quite extensively. Yeah.
Could you explain that point again? How do you look at the Lorentz transformation representations? They're block diagonal, sure. How can we say from those that the spinners are reducible?
Well, this is basically I can act this on, this whole thing, onto this W plus and W minus. Right? I can act this whole thing onto this W plus, W minus. And if you do that, this is what I write. So it's simply like multiplying your rotation matrix with this guy, multiplying your boost matrix with this guy. And then you realize why do we say that it's reducible? Because as you say, in Lorentz transformation, W plus is still W plus. W minus is still W minus. They are never mixed. So if they are not irreducible representation, then during a Lorentz transformation, they will be mixed somehow. Since they remain separated, no matter you rotate it or you boost it, they still remain separated. So at the first place, we just never have to consider they are together. And they are together is purely a historical fact that Dirac write down the Dirac equation first. As from a mathematical point of view, if you are like, I just want to find all the possible representation of Lorentz group, this should be what you're after first. And then later, you know, you compare some notes and make some Dirac spinner. Actually, in today's tutorial, you will study, at the end, you will study how, if you're given two well spinner, how do we make two well spinner of one type, how do you make a Dirac spinner of? Okay, so this is just the definition of a well spinner. Well, the definition of a well spinner says, in the Carroll-Weil basis. Both the rotation and boost matrices block diagonal. Then the Dirac spinner can be simply split as the upper half two component and the lower half two component, and they're each an irreducible representation of Lorentz group, and they're called the Weil spinner. But at this point, you should be suspicious. Why so? Because we picked a particularly nice representation. We handpick our gamma matrix such that these two things are diagonal. But as I said, you can pick any basis you want. The physics shouldn't depend on that. So your rotational matrix could have looked completely a disaster, like there's nothing you can see through, like it could have been blocked diagonal. Which means Weil spinner is certainly not always separate like that. So the new task is, what if it's convenient somehow to use some other basis, but the concept that Psi should be able to separate it into two Weil spinner, that's a physical concept. Irreducible representation, that's physical. How do we extract that physics if we're not in this particular good basis? So for a general basis, how to get Weil spinner? Well, we want to project our Dirac spinner into two halves, right? So that's what we use projection operator to do. Let me remind you what the projection operator does, is that it's something, say, I have a bunch of them, I hope them add up to the identity, so that after projection, I was not missing anything. And then, the other thing I hope is if you project to yourself and then you project again, there's nothing happens. Project once is good enough. And there is some also condition, apparently it's not always required, but it's good anyway, is that it's Hermitian. And then this thing is nice, says that it's orthogonal. You can make a non-orthogonal projection operator. But only if it's orthogonal, then it's better. So let's review these conditions. It wants to square back to itself. It wants something Hermitian. And we played with, and you were wondering why yesterday you spent so much time with this guy, which is apparently called gamma 5 because it's a fifth gamma matrix. Remember, there's good property about this guy, it has a square to one. That can't be a bad property. And then it has gamma five is Hermitian, hop, right there. And then I also asked you to anti-commute with everybody else. It turned out it anti-commuted with everybody else. So these are the three properties you have looked at yesterday. Most of you guys get all of them. And why this is very, very good for us? Because now I can make projection operator out of them. So let's examine this guy. Well, clearly, if you add the p plus and the p minus, you're going to get a 1. Now we'll just do a p plus square. I'll square this guy, because very nicely, gamma 5 square go back to 1, this go back to 4. Thank you. This go back to itself. And you can see why P minus probably worked too. And it's an interesting exercise to see these two are even orthogonal, so even better. Now we have our projection operators. We happily define our while spanner in any base and any basis that is like that. You just project. And now there is an important comment. Why it is so important that a gamma 5 needs to be anti-commute with all the gamma nukes? That's to ensure that it will commute with two of them. So if you anti-commute with one of them, and now you have two of them, you will say this is implied by what you showed before. And this is the Lorentz generator. So this is very important because this shows gamma 5 and Lorentz transformation commutes so that we can project it, and then you can do whatever boost the rotation that wouldn't change your projection. So if you project it and then it's immediately changed, then it defeats our purpose. We need to project them in a way that is compatible with Lorentz transformation. So that's it. That's how we define our well spinner in general. And it's some calculation involved, but not much. In well basis, that's gamma 5, and that's P plus, that's P minus. You can see, indeed, P plus, which is pick up the top half, and P minus will just pick up the bottom half. So this general discussion about how to project to get a wild spanner agrees with this intuition in this particularly nice spaces, which is just the top two half and the bottom two half. If I want to write explicitly, in this case, psi plus is literally W plus, and nothing on the bottom, and plus minus is W minus with nothing on the top. So at this point, as I said, this is just our mathematical curiosity to find some easier things to study. And in today's tutorial, you will have the opportunity to study two things, just called chirality and the helicity. So chirality is basically the eigenvalue of gamma 5. And helicity is like the projection of momentum operator onto the angular momentum operator onto the momentum operator. These are things that are interesting. And the tutorial focuses on an interesting question is that in the literature of both books, that the people are always saying things like left-handed and right-handed. And we'll do an investigation on it. And we realize that when you say things are left-handed or right-handed, actually it's very ambiguous if you mean left chiral or left helicity. And even that, it's not very precise definition, but we'll see that this afternoon. We'll hopefully clear the confusion about all the left-handed and right-handed well spinner. If we didn't, then on Thursday we'll regroup and trying to clear it again. But I hope the tutorial will help. But let's move on. So on the same notion of we're discussing simpler things. See, you have 4 degrees of, you have 4-component spanners, and you can say, they are actually 2-component spanners. Then there's other things we can do. And this is what Mariana did for us. ask a different question. Says, in the scalar case, we have this complex scalar, but we can certainly impose, says, its own complex conjugate, and then you get a real scalar. A real scalar is probably easier to study than a complex scalar. So Mariana asks this question, can I do the same for the Dirac spinner? Can I have, and you know, if you impose such a thing, let's call it the reality condition, then you sort of make Dirac spinner real, then maybe things are easier. And at first you were like, why not? But then you think about it, well, there is a problem, isn't it? Look, there's a complex number in this rotation matrix, even if I can impose the real condition and set psi star to psi, and now I go to a different frame, which is simply rotated from the original frame, they pick up some complex numbers. Okay, so there is that. So then, well, Mariana says, okay, I'm gonna resolve the question to search in the case that the Lorentz generator themselves is real. Then your Lorentz transformation are all real matrices. If they are real matrices, there's no problem. You impose the real condition, you can do whatever rotation boost you want, you will still have a real condition. And he found it. So you can go through some similar step to calculate what this is. I think you already calculated S mu nu Geiger in the quiz. So the S mu nu star, I think it's a little easier calculation to show that this is really saying that gamma mu star should be either real or purely imaginary. So if it's real, of course, if all the gamma is real, then of course this is satisfied. And if it's pure imaginary, then it picks up a minus sign from each of the gammas. So then that's fine too. It turns out the gamma matrix cannot be all real. So Mariana finds this purely imaginary basis, which I'm really just listing here as a completion of the discussion. You can show that this thing, they are good gamma matrices, they satisfy all those conditions. You are certainly not required to know this. This is a full compilation of study. This is found. This is a pure imaginary, also known as the Mariana basis. And since this is pure imaginary, the Lorentz generator is real, you impose the reality condition, you make the Dirac spinner simpler. Because now you have a real Dirac spinner, which is called the Mariana spinner. And then you should be suspicious again. Because Mariana accomplished whatever he is doing by going to the very special basis that he discovered on his own. But what if you are in the general basis? There should be, since we know that there exists a Mariana spinner that is less complicated Dirac spinner, if it's doable in one basis, it must be doable in a general basis. It's the same idea as before. If you can separate a wild spinner Dirac into two well spinner in one basis, there's gotta be some way to separate it in other bases too. But as we already mentioned, that psi star equals psi is just not gonna work. Because we don't have real Lorentz generator anymore. So what people does is say, okay, complex conjugation is just not good enough. Let me define this thing called a C conjugation. It's like complex conjugation, but we throw a constant matrix there to mix it up a little bit. And hopefully, this is possible. It's like try to impose psi and psi star, and this condition is way too strong. So we loosen it a bit. We say, man, you can multiply a constant matrix too. We will still call it a reality condition because it's still something equals its complex conjugate with modification. So this is also known as the reality condition. Okay, suppose this is possible. What do we want? What we want is that a psi and the psi C conjugate these two things transform the same way. This makes a lot of sense. We're going to impose the two things are equal. If the two things are literally equal, then under Lorentz transformation, they'd better transform the same way. Otherwise, they are not going to be equal in a different way. And the second condition we impose is that they both satisfy Dirac equation. Well, we know that psi satisfies Dirac equation. And if we're going to impose psi C to equal psi, then psi C should also satisfy the Dirac equation. And the last but not least, it's kind of nice if you conjugate something twice, you get back to yourself. And this is an easy condition. It says CC star equals 1. And we'll take a look at how could they transform the same way. So let's rewrite that. So this thing is divided by some constant matrix times the psi star. And then we're gonna hopefully this equals psi. And now we want them to transform the same way. We know how psi transform. This is by definition, it transforms as S lambda times psi. And then, of course, you ask, how does the C psi star transform? Psi star transform as you star both of the things. And then you ask, what's C? Psi star transform. Well, C is a constant matrix, so it's just tagging along. But on the other hand, that's not what we want. We want this thing transform exactly like psi. And the psi transform as whatever it is, it just multiply by S lambda. This is what we want. This is what we mean by this transform like psi. So of course, now we compare to the right-hand side and realize the condition is S lambda C equals C S star lambda. And you can do some computation, realize this property from the finite generator pass on to the generator, the finite transformation passed on the generator easily. It just become a generator, and that star become generator star. And now we have our condition says S mu nu star had better be C inverse S mu nu C. And now you can plug in the commutator of gamma mu and the gamma nu in. So this condition transfer onto the gamma matrices says that if this is going to happen, then gamma mu should equal this. So this is maybe a 2 or 3 line calculation. Just plug it in and realize this condition will guarantee the psi and the psi c transform the same thing. And then the Dirac equation pick the minus sign. So there's ambiguity, but the Dirac equation says this condition should be minus. So there is a interesting exercise. If you want, this C conjugate satisfy the Dirac equation, the sign is actually fixed, and there's no other condition coming from it. So that's it. If you want to impose Mirani condition, you just need to search for a same matrix, satisfy this equation with a minus sign, then you impose psi equals psi c conjugate, and this condition will hold for all Lorentz frame. And as an example that you can check, for example, in our favorite basis. In the well basis, you can check this thing called I gamma 2 will fit the bill. This thing will satisfy that condition, so you can actually start with a Dirac spinner that has two well spinner and impose it to be equals to this C constant matrix times the complex conjugate of the spinner. And if you work out, you can express W minus in terms W plus complex conjugate. And you can write this Mirani spinner, the real spinner, all in terms of the plus component, like this. And indeed, this thing is simpler than Dirac, because the Dirac spinner, after imposing the Mirani condition, turns out only depend on W plus, which is a two-component spinner. And in a very interesting way. So the Weil spinner and the Mirani spinner are two cousins of Dirac spinner. And the Weil spinner says, Weil condition says that we can, in the Weil basis, let's just talk in Weil basis. In Weil basis, the Weil spinner is either top half or the bottom half, and it's two Weil spinner. And in the Mirani spinner, if you want to get a real spinner out of any Dirac spinner, you can say, oh, I can express it, we can, the top component and the bottom two components are actually related. Okay, so far we're doing it in mathematical sense. These are some interesting object to spinner, component spinner. They are less complicated. And this afternoon we'll see how they are related to physics in some way. And on Thursday, we'll talk about the symmetries of the Dirac Lagrangian. Then we'll really, really emphasize why these little two spinners should be something we care about. Well, I can say one sentence here is that our world, this world we live in, all these electrons, quarks, all these fermions, we study here fermions, they are well spin. In the true world, if you say talk about an electron Dirac spinner, the top component and the bottom component interact differently. Only one half, only one, so there were two electron well spinner, and only one of them interact with the weak theory, which is responsible for the beta decay. And the other part just doesn't participate. So that's what we understand the world to be. I'll say a little bit more on the experiment size on Thursday, but if you really want to understand a weak interaction, of course you have to take the standard model course. Okay, now it's a perfect time to have 5 minute break. And after break, we'll solve the Dirac equation. We have a good equation, we should solve it. And then we can land on the Dirac Lagrangian, which is my goal from the first day, is that I want to give you a Lagrangian that you don't just frown on me and says, what is this? Okay, see you in 5 minutes. All right, solve the Dirac equation. So first, we'll introduce this very interesting notation. It's somehow very convenient to do this such that our gamma mu just looks like a sigma mu, sigma bar mu, right? It's just a notation because it's 1, 1, but it's sigma I minus sigma I. So in the well basis, that gamma nu can be defined this way by defining something four-dimensional Pauli matrices by introducing identity into the game. That's just a bookkeeping formula. And now we want to solve our phenomenal Dirac equation. Okay, so what do we do? We have an nonsense. Let's have an nonsense. Says psi is something a plane wave. Psi is always a plane wave. Except a plane wave, it doesn't have an index. I have to evolve this spinnerness somehow. So basically what we claim is that a psi is a typical psi, probably carrying a fixed momentum.
I don't think there's a bar inside the...
Yeah, it's not...
I mean how you define a sigma matrices.
Right. No, sorry, that's a vector.
Oh, okay.
Sorry. The vector is very indistinguishable
from bar.
It just says that there are three of them.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. See, this is a nice answer. The answer says, for a given, that's not gonna work. For a given plane wave carrying momentum p, then the Dirac spinner as a solution must have a plane wave part, but then also have something carry the spinner index, and it probably depend on the moment. Yeah? And the thing we're gonna do is to plug in there. Let's do the plane wave part first so we can drop it later. So I hope you have done this many times, that you will bring a minus I p mu down so this thing gets p mu. And then of course, plane wave is still here. So I can rewrite the Dirac equation for this particular plane wave in the following way. then I'll just drop the plane waves.
Sorry, over here is the I in the parentheses. I is only for the first.
You are definitely correct. Yep, thank you. But you end up like with this, right? The only thing I did is do the derivative in the plane wave and throw the plane wave away. So now we have an equation for this UP thing, whatever the spinner thing that we need to solve satisfy this equation. And because gamma mu has such a nice form, I can write it as sigma times p, sigma bar times p, and then I'll put the identity matrix carried by here back. And now, okay, I'll introduce a very weird notation, and I'll immediately throw it away. It's just for this part of the. I don't know, I can't write upper index because it's reserved for spin label. I can't write downward index because that's reserved for spin index. I'm running out of all kinds of characters and I realize in Chinese. So that this is just Chinese E, Chinese R, just one, two. It will be gone very quickly. But the idea is that this equation is a 4x4 matrix equation. I can write it in a 2x2 block form, right? Not a block diagonal, but in terms of a bunch of 2x2 matrix. And this telling us there are two equations related to this UE and the UR things. They are related, right? This is a two linear equation. I must be able to somehow solve it. So I could have just written my solution as I'll pick a random first component, and the second one is quote unquote a function of the first, right? That's what we mean by there are two variables, two linear equations. I must be able to express this variable in terms of that itself. And nobody uses that because it's not pretty. You kind of want the prettiness because we have to use it to do a lot of calculation. So I'll leave it to yourself to convince yourself such that that thing can also be written as this very pretty form. Okay, let me explain what's going on. So basically, it's still the same. It has the upper two component, the bottom two component. As you can see, they collectively depends on this Casey thing, which let's just, at this point, you can take Casey 1 to be 1, 0, this one to be 0, 1. So there are two independent two component spinner. So with some calculation, you can show this are all equivalent with some overall constants. And this is a much prettier form. In general, you only require this to be orthonormal. But in practice, everybody chose 1, 0 and 0, 1 because they are very easy. And what does the solution say? This solution says U is a four-component spinner. And so it says two things. U is a four-component spinner. And each component can be calculated using this. And if in the tutorial, if you get to the last question in order, it says, let's look at a particular example and understand this weird looking solution better. But the most important thing is that it has two solutions. because you can say the S can be one and two. There are two independent solutions. Each of them has four components. So that's what you are. And the psi is nothing but this thing multiplied by the plane wave part. And of course, you can repeat this exercise. I'm not super excited to suggest you to do that. I'd rather you follow one very carefully. And if you're out of time, you don't have to follow it. But this is the important part. There are two solutions. We found two solutions, independent solutions. And each solution is a four-component spinner. So of course, you can do figure this out with the other plane wave. And now I'll skip all parts. And it says, guess what? It's not a surprise. I'm not a surprise at all. But we got another two solution. And this eight has, I like the C's. I'm changing the letter just because you don't have to pick this guy to be the same as that is. That's the only reason I'm changing letters. But the idea is that V is also a four-component spinner. And we also have two V-type solutions. And if you really want to hear the jargon, there are two solutions corresponding to the positive frequency, and then there is two solutions corresponding to the negative frequency. But as you have studied it in the scalar field, these positive negative frequency things are not that appreciated in the quantum field theory. So that is. You're welcome to follow in the lecture notes how these solutions exactly come up, how do you go from here to this very pretty form that you have to use a couple of pretty identities about a sigma dot p and a sigma bar dot p. But these are the four solutions. So all together, we found the four solutions. And in the tutorial, hopefully you will see that sometimes they are referring as a, for U solution, they are often referred as a spin-up particle and a spin-down particle. So that's two solutions. And for the Vs, they are often referred as a spin-up antiparticle and a spin-down antiparticles. So that's where the four solutions are. There's the spin up electron, spin down electron, spin up positron, spin down positron, and that's why we have four solutions. And now we'll do this thing to assemble them together. Says that given a Dirac spinner, the most general solution is, of course, giving them a bunch of coefficients. That's what we do. You can see that it's slightly longer than your scalar equivalence, because that now we have some U's and V's hanging around carrying our spinner. So, but the idea is saying that's our spinner part of the solution, that's the plane wave of the solution. For each individual solution, they should come with some different coefficients. For later convenience, they are called the B, S of P, and the CS star of the P. You used to have like A of P and A star of P in the complex case. So that's the upgraded version. And right, because B, we will see it's the particle C are the antiparticles, so we have to use different letter. And they definitely carry a spin label to tell us if they are spin up or spin down. In the tutorial, we'll say why it's related to spin. And the this is the mode expansion of Dirac field. And as usual, the first time I write it, I'll keep all your index here. There's a spinner index. Spinner index is carried by the solution. As we just solve it, it has four components. But in addition to that, there is this S running 1 to 2, meaning that we have 2 this kind of a solution and 2 this kind of solution. In general, nobody cares about writing things carefully. So what people normally write is, well, as things get more complicated, and you would see the reason why we don't carry all the index around. The most likely index to be dropped is the spinner index. And then you are using, well, often using the improved Einstein summation convention, meaning that even if both two indices are upper, we'll still assume that it's not. And this is just my own convention, because I'm going to write this way too many times on the board. So I decide to call this the correct momentum volume integral. And you can see it's very convenient. This kind of thing always cancels out. You have some other normalization constants coming from like a commutator relationship or anti-commutator relationship. So they always cancel out. All the integration, how those normalization constants are designed exactly serve the purpose so they can cancel out. So I figure I might as well just not write it. So often you will see me write this. By this I meant that. Means there's a summation and there is spinner index. Also means that the integral constant is right. Then we finally get to our main point today, which is look at the Dirac Lagrangian. It's very good because we already seen the most important step in your quiz. So that. Because after we get the Dirac Lagrangian, then all possibilities are open. We can basically just follow whatever Dan said in the first half and then redo it for Dirac spinner. That's actually exactly what we're going to do starting on Friday. Thursday, we have some symmetry issues to solve. But let's get to this very, very important Lagrangian first. There, it's really nice. You just write this down. You're like, it's Lorentz environment. It must be a good Lagrangian term. And then, so for Dirac field, what do you think it would be a good candidate if you have not seen Dirac Lagrangian before and just generalize from the complex scalar case? What would be a first guess? First, you change the complex conjugate into Hermitian, right? It's a very nice first guess. Says now you have more than one component, I guess. We have to transpose it, otherwise it's not a scalar. It's not anything if you don't transpose. Very good. So our task would be looking at how this thing transforms. Well, we know psi transform as S psi, so psi dagger must transform psi dagger S dagger. So this thing must transform as psi dagger as psi. And now you're like, hey, S dagger S, if all this Lorentz transformation S, they are unitary, wouldn't that just nice, they just disappear and then we get back to psi dagger psi. See, that's why the question about is rotation matrix unitary, is boost matrix unitary, is an important question. because you have already seen in the specific example, they are not always unitary. Actually, there is a fundamental mathematics theorem is against our wish. The mathematical theorem says if you have a non-compact Lie group, then you will not find finite dimension unitary representation. And Lorentz group is manifestly not compact because it's like infinite extension to R3, right? Okay, so we know this is not going to work. But the good thing is yesterday you have worked out what's this guy. This guy is this thing, right? That's one of your quiz problems, is to work out this. With that, it's much easier to work out what is this thing. I just put it in the exponential, and I realize if you do this exponential Taylor expansion, you realize gamma zero literally just come out. And this minus sign, okay, I'll just write it. One more step. If it's minus sign on the exponential, it turned out to be the S inverse. Right? So instead of being S inverse itself, I stagger is actually gamma zero, S inverse gamma zero. Okay, so let's put this back in. S dagger is gamma zero, S inverse gamma zero. Now you have S. Okay, well, this is definitely not Psi dagger Psi. It's very annoying. See, if this thing just meet each other and cancel, wouldn't that be nice? So then we were like, how do I fix this problem? So this is just a line separating the Psi dagger and the Psi. The way to fix a problem is to use the nice property of the gamma zero. It says, if I just stick a gamma zero there, well, of course, you can't do it only on one side, so I should stick a gamma zero on the left side, too. And that'd be nice, because gamma zero is squared to be one. I managed to bring S inverse and S together, they disappear, and they have a leftover gamma zero to look like on the left side. Interesting, isn't it? And this is very important. And it has a name. And it's even named after the great Dirac. This is called the Dirac conjugate. And anything we want to build that is a Lorentz invariant quantity that can be used as part of Lagrange and stuff, we have to use Dirac conjugate. So this thing would happen again, again, again. We always needed this gamma zero to be around to cancel some extra gamma zero such that S and S inverse can disappear. So now we found one piece of our Dirac Lagrangian says this one. Now we can just add a mass term says, hey, that's a pretty good Lagrangian term. It's Lorentz invariant. And proportion to mass. Maybe that's the mass term. Who knows? We have a pretty good shot. So the next step is to be very, very bold with this Dirac conjugate. Says, oh, we have this great, awesome Dirac conjugate. If I just stick a gamma nu there, and we can ask the question, can this be somehow Lorentz covariant? Because it can't be a scalar, so is this a vector? And the answer is yes. And you can see in the notes how it's derived. Basically, you say, let's demand this transform as a vector, and you are landing on the condition that is exactly the condition we impose on gamma matrix on the S lambda for Psi to transform in the correct way anyway. So The moral of the story is you can just insert a random combination of gamma matrices in between the sidebar and the psi, and you can always show that will be Lorentz covariance. It will transform correctly Lorentz with the Lorentz transformation. You just need some other vector to contract it to actually build a Lorentz invariant Lagrangian. But these are the ingredients. So now we can finally build our Lagrangian. So here is the Dirac equation, the left-hand side of Dirac equation. And the simplest thing we can do is just put a psi bar here. Because all the Lagrangian equation says we can just take the derivative with respect to the psi bar. Since the psi bar, it doesn't have a derivative, this is my Dirac equation. And if you take this guy, take the derivative of psi bar, oh, you land up with Dirac equation. And if you look at every term, this term is precise of the form psi bar gamma mu psi, and multiplied by another vector. So that's valid. And then the second term is the mass term we discovered. So this is our Dirac Lagrangian, and you can calculate the momentum, the conjugated momentum, and then realize it's I psi dagger. Let's just follow the whatever, however way you, however you like. You have a Lagrangian, you can just do psi L, psi, psi 0, psi, something like that. And you'll get this thing. And this, I strongly recommend the exits. So this is a strongly recommend. Okay. So now I have a tricky questions to ask. It's more like a seemingly paradox. So the question is, how many degrees of freedom actually does Dirac field has? I have the following argument. You are supposed to find where I did a mistake. My argument is a scalar field has 1 degree of freedom. Everybody agrees that? Yeah? And then now I have the complex scalar field. Because it's a complex, now I have 2 degrees of freedom. Psi is a 4-component spinner, and each component is complex. So I conclude there must be 8 degrees of freedom. And I just realized I found the 4 solutions. Aren't I supposed to find like equal number of solutions as my degrees of freedom? What happens to my very sound reasoning?
So the first component of the spinner and the second component of the spinner are not linearly independent. Like there's some relation between them.
No, all the 4 components are linear independent.
Linear independent is wrong statement. I would say that there's a function. The first component is a function of the second component, or there's some relation between them.
That's what it says here is that I found a 2 solution. Yeah, exactly. So your argument is support that we did have 4 solutions and we only have 4. The question is why? I would expect 8. I have 4 complex. Well, I have a 4 complex component spinner. Same to be 8 to me.
Because in the in the scalar field, we had this thing that the time derivative was free as well. We had to discuss.
Excellent.
That. And here we have the momentum is not a time derivative.
Excellent. The idea is in classical physics, how do we decide the degree of freedom? Let's go all the way back to a free particle roaming in this room. A free particle roaming in this room, we need to provide x, y, z, and px, py, pz, so i.e. the phase space. And then we decide that there is three positions, three momentum, so six dimensions phase space, and divided by two, I get 3 degrees of freedom. So interestingly, degrees of freedom is defined by the phase space dimension divided by two. And now we can look at our Dirac spinner. For the position, the field, we have 8. And for the momentum, we still have 8, but it's the same 8. As Even points out that we don't need to provide any information on the time derivative of the psi to be able to solve the system. Since it's the same 8, the phase space dimension is actually 8. Because you can't count them twice. This is psi. This is psi dagger. If you count the psi contains 8 real degrees of freedom, then it contains real degrees of things. And the psi dagger has exactly the same information. There's no extra information when any by looking at the conjugate moment. And that's why we have degree of freedom is 4. Which is nice, because we found 4 solutions. That's exactly what we are. And if you think about it, you of course will conclude, oh, well, spinner must only have 2 degrees of freedom. Marijuana spinner must have only 2 degrees of freedom. And that's why we say they're easy. All right.